The very first disciple that Jesus called was Simon Peter. Remember Peter and Andrew in the boat? The first disciple to recognize who Jesus was Simon Peter. Thou art the Christ. The disciple who told Jesus he would follow him anywhere. I'm never going to leave you. I'll never forsake you, was Simon Peter. The disciple who even went to the Garden of Gethsemane armed with a weapon and was prepared to fight to the death. Remember, he started the fight. He pulled out the sword. He cut off the ear of one of the soldiers until Jesus said, "We don't fight with weapons." That was Simon Peter. And according to John's Gospel, the very first disciple to actually discover the empty tomb after Mary Magdalene had come and said, "He's not in the tomb," it was Simon Peter who literally walked into the tomb, and he was the first disciple who saw the burial clothes and the tomb was empty. That was Simon Peter. And one of the great mysteries of the Bible is what happened to Simon Peter after that. Because one would think if I was writing the story, I would have Simon Peter to march away from the empty tomb and go straight to the home of Caiaphas the high priest and announce, "He is no longer in the grave. The one you crucified is alive." But you know what it says in John's Gospel? It was the scripture that we had a couple of weeks ago on Easter Sunday. After he discovered the empty tomb, he went home. Going home, man. He just went home. What's up with that? John did too, by the way. There are two post-resurrection accounts in the 20th chapter of John. One is actually that night, the night of the resurrection. You remember the disciples are scared to death. They're behind locked doors and Jesus appears and he breathes on them. Now the significance of that is that breath is the symbol of life. And he breathes on them and says, "Receive the Holy Spirit." And one of the disciples we know was not there. That was Thomas. And then he makes that grand pronouncement, "Until I put my fingers in the nail prints in his hands and my hand in his side, I'll not believe." So 8 days later, Jesus appears and gives Thomas that opportunity. But the amazing thing is, the two leading disciples, Simon Peter and John, are not even mentioned. And if you read the end of the 20th chapter, it's like the gospel has ended. I mean, John ends that 20th chapter as a conclusion. But if he had left it there, we never would have known what happened to Simon Peter. And so he adds another chapter. It's the passage that Dan read a few minutes ago. Now, the first thing you notice is the disciples are no longer in Jerusalem. They have all gone back home to Galilee. And they're on the Sea of Galilee, and Simon Peter makes the statement, "I'm going fishing." Now, I wonder what he meant by that. You see, the life that Simon Peter knew before Jesus was the life of a fisherman. And maybe what Simon Peter was saying was this: "I failed miserably. I promised Jesus my total devotion, total commitment, my whole life, and I failed. And I just need to go back to the way things were before, to life before Jesus." Somebody said the reason Simon Peter went back home was he was afraid he would run into Jesus. He's a little bit embarrassed, don't you think? I mean, he was devastated. Because we all know what happened on that Thursday night after Jesus was arrested in the garden. Simon Peter follows him to the home of Caiaphas. And standing outside the home of Caiaphas, he denies him not once, not twice, but three times. Never heard of this guy. I don't know who you're talking about. He failed. And so maybe he was saying, I've just got to go back to the way things were before. But maybe there was something else. Because if you read that passage, if you listen to the passage from John 21 that Dan read, if you go back to the fifth chapter of Luke, and Luke gives us more details on the calling of Simon Peter, there is an uncanny resemblance to what happens in John 21. It almost sounds like a repeat of the same story when Jesus first called Simon Peter. In Luke chapter 5, Jesus actually borrowed Simon Peter's boat because there were so many people, and he kind of went out in the lake a little bit, used his boat, had a nice sermon, and then he looked at Simon Peter. He said, "Hey man, let's go fishing." And Simon said, "Won't do any good, they're not biting." I think Simon must have known Johnny Rhodes. I mean, he knew all about fishing. He said, "There's no point in going fishing." And here I imagine that Jesus, with a twinkle in his eye, said, "You've never been fishing with me." So here they go. You know what happened. He said, "Put the net right out here." They put the net down there. There were so many fish that the net almost broke. Just amazing. And then Simon Peter recognizes that this is a God thing. And he falls on his knees. And Jesus said, "You follow me and I'm going to make you a fisherman of men." Whoa. That's when it all started. Maybe there was something in Simon Peter's mind that wanted to go back. He wanted to go back to that moment when he first felt the call. When he first experienced Jesus, when the world was idealized but his commitment was unqualified, a long time before he made all the mistakes, wouldn't it be wonderful if we could just go back? You see, I think one reason a lot of times you'll see things like this and you'll say, "Well, I'm not going to fill one of these out because I've made a commitment before and I just failed miserably. I was supposed to lead a committee and I didn't even call a meeting. I was supposed to teach Sunday school and I wouldn't even show up. I failed. And so they can just go on without me." Simon Peter out there in the boat, they'd fished all night, hadn't caught a thing, and suddenly they see a stranger over on the shore. He said, "You guys caught anything?" "Not a thing." And then he said, "Why don't you cast your net on the other side of the boat?" When he said that, a light went off. Simon Peter had a feeling, "I've been here before." And then when they started to bring up the net, and when it was just tremendous amount of fish, and it almost broke the net, more than they could even haul in, Simon Peter recognizes, "It is the Lord." And he jumps into the water. He swims to the shore. And there's Jesus. And the first thing John tells us is there was a charcoal fire. Now I wonder why didn't he just say Jesus was frying some fish? Why does he say charcoal fire? Because the last time we find Simon Peter before the crucifixion, he is standing before a charcoal fire outside of the home of Caiaphas. And John said he was standing beside the charcoal fire when he denied Jesus. Don't you know for the rest of his life, every time he smelled charcoal smoke, his mind went back to that night when he failed him. And that's why Jesus asked him not once, not twice, but three times, "Do you love me?" and feed my sheep. If you notice the gathering in the bulletin, it talks about the fact that this is a recommissioning. This is a recalling. We've all failed. We've all been like Simon Peter, but Jesus invites us to try again. He can erase the past. He says, forget what happened before. It's time now to hear again the call. Now, a couple of other interesting things are going on here. When the disciples get to the shore, Jesus has prepared breakfast. And you know what was on the menu? Fish and bread. Seems like I recall one other meal that Jesus provided when fish and bread were on the menu. I think it would be super if John had said there were 5 loaves of bread and 2 fish. Now let me ask you a question. If Jesus can feed 5,000 people with 5 loaves and 2 fish, does He need us? I mean, He can do it, can't He? But this is what happens. You see, they had all of these fish, and Jesus said, bring some of your fish. Oh yeah, I can do it, but I need your help. I can't do it without what you have, without your gifts, without your talents, without your resources. Jesus doesn't need us to accomplish His work, but that's the way He has decided to establish His kingdom, is using us to be a part of this great endeavor to share God's love with the world. And then there's one other thing that John tells us that I find to be absolutely fascinating. He tells us exactly how many fish. Did you notice that? Dan, it was 153 fish. Large fish. That's a whole bunch of fish. Now, immediately, people are going to say, what is the significance of 153? Because John doesn't just pass out details at random. There has to be more to the story. Well, if you've been in the Bible study on the 23rd Psalm, you know we talked about the fact that in biblical times they assign numerical value to names and to the letters. And so people have gone crazy trying to decide what this means. And guess what? This is the most interesting theory. If you take the name of the person who first went to the empty tomb and add up the Greek letters of Mary Magdalene, you get 153. But I think that's just coincidence. I just think that's a stretch. Some people have said, well, you know, you take the number 12 for the 12 tribes of Israel, the number 12 for the 12 disciples, you have 12 times 12, 144. It means all the people of God, you know, 144,000 in the book of Revelation. And then you add the Trinity, the Father, Son, Holy Spirit, 3 times 3 times 3 equals 9. And then you add it all together, you get 153. But again, I think that's a stretch. I think John is telling us exactly how many fish is because he wants us to understand that every single one is important. And that in God's kingdom, we cannot leave anyone out. And that's why he was so specific. And so we're going to do something now. We're going to do something to illustrate the fact that all of us are tied together. And all of us are needed to make it happen. I see it's already working up in the balcony. In every section, there you will find somebody's going to have a skein of yarn. And what we're going to have you do is you're going to start to unravel the yarn. And as you unravel the yarn, I want you to hold on to it and pass it on. And we have enough yarn so that everybody in this sanctuary will be holding on to the yarn. And while you're doing that, I've got a story to tell you. So you're going to have to do 2 things at once. And this is a good story. This is a baseball story. George, are you awake? because you need to pay attention to this. I hope Harold's awake back at Austin Brook. Scott, this is a baseball that I caught at an Atlanta Braves game 39 years ago on April the 12th, 1974. Now, you say, boy, that's amazing. Ray Howell has a baseball that he got at a Major League Baseball game back in 1974. That's something to be proud of. But you know what? Every time I look at this baseball, I think about what might have been. You see, one of the most iconic, mythical figures in baseball was the Sultan of Swat, Babe Ruth. And a record that was considered to be unreachable for many, many years was Babe Ruth's 714 home runs. Babe Ruth was the home run king of baseball. And they said nobody would ever have more than 714 home runs. But you all know the story of Hammering Hank. Henry Aaron from Mobile, Alabama, who was with the Milwaukee Braves and then the Atlanta Braves. And at the end of the 1973 season, Hank Aaron had 713 home runs. That meant he needed one home run to tie the record and one home run to break the record. It was all everybody was talking about in the spring of 1974. Well, I was a sophomore in college in Birmingham, Alabama. And I was with a bunch of my buddies one day, and we started talking about, wouldn't it be wonderful if we could be there? If we could be there the night that Hank Aaron breaks the home run record. And so we called the Atlanta Braves. Now, the Braves were starting in Cincinnati with a three-game series, and then they were going to Atlanta. So a few months out, we called the Atlanta Braves, and we said, do you still have any tickets available for opening night? And they said, yes, as a matter of fact, we do. And I said, we need six tickets. Can you give us six tickets? Now, this is a long time before the internet and all this, so I'm on the phone, and the lady said, yes, in fact, I've got some pretty good seats. We can get six tickets for opening night, April the 8th, 1974. And so I said, we want those tickets. And so she did all the stuff, and then she said, now let me read this back to you. I've got six tickets for April the 8th on a Monday night against the Los Angeles Dodgers. And I went, Monday night? I thought it was a Friday night. And she said, no, we're opening at home on a Monday night. And so I said, guys, it's a Monday night. I mean, we're in school. We wouldn't get home till like 3 or 4 in the morning. We need to be responsible students. We don't need to be over there. And then one of the guys said, he's not going to do it that night anyway. Oh, he wouldn't break it that night. So I said, what's the Friday night? She said, April the 12th, Cincinnati Reds. We said, that's going to be the night. So we got six tickets to see the Braves and the Reds on Friday night, April the 12th. First swing of the season in Cincinnati, Hank Aaron ties the record. He goes to Atlanta on April the 8th on a Monday night, only needing one home run to break the all-time home run record. There is a record crowd of 53,775 in Atlanta Fulton County Stadium. NBC is broadcasting the game live. And in the fourth inning, off of Al Downing of the Dodgers, Henry Hammering Hank Aaron breaks the greatest record in all of baseball history when he hits a home run. And we're sitting in our dorm room watching it on a black and white television, saying we could have been there. We went on Friday night. There were only 8,000 people there. The Braves got beat 14-2. By the fifth inning, everybody else had left. They knocked a foul ball into the left field stands. There were 10,000 seats, two people. I outran the other guy and got the ball. You have an opportunity. Don't blow it. Don't say, well, I'm just going to wait. That's not convenient. Phyllis Stump talked to the Kiwanis Club on Thursday, and she said, when God opens the door, then you just need to walk through it. And so this is an opportunity for us. This is an opportunity for us to make a difference, to be involved in our church, to start all over again. Has the yarn gone all the way around? Everybody's got a piece of it? You see, it takes all of us. It takes all of us working together. It takes all of us taking advantage of the opportunity. Yesterday at Camp Kiwanis, when we finished all the work, there was a high school girl that led us in prayer, and it was the most beautiful prayer. She said, God, you know that faith without action is not faith, and we thank you for the opportunity that you've given us today to make a difference in the lives of these children. You have the opportunity. You have the opportunity to make a difference in this church and in this community. And as we sing together our hymn, Come All Christians, Be Committed, if you would like to come down to the front, and if you'd like to put your forms in the basket, you can do so, or you can wait until the service is over, or you can think about it and send it to us at any time. But I hope that all of us will take advantage of the opportunity to make a difference for God and for His kingdom. Let us stand and let us sing.